So let's restart. Two things before we move on. The second one is that the question that who asked, maybe Iran asked about the normalization, reminded me that actually proving that it's a universal finite type invariant is easier than proving that it's an invariant. So maybe I'll first prove the universality. But even before that, I want to reiterate why is it called universal finite type invariant? So why is a Z which satisfies the property stated here called a universal finite type invariant? Okay? And the reason is that it contains, it's not a finite type invariant in itself, but it contains in it all possible finite type invariants. So part of it I've already shown, and in fact I've given enough hints to for everything else as well, but let me just be clear about the rest, okay? So to remind you, I have shown already that if such as that Z, so given Z, if you give me a weight system W, then if you compose Z with W, you get a numerical invariant V, whose, and then the weight system of the V that you thus got is W. Okay? But I claim that this means that any finite type invariant whatsoever is a composition of V with something. I mean, this W is a homogeneous W in A reduced M star. But I claim that if you drop this homogeneity, you can get any finite type invariant whatsoever. Indeed, suppose Vm is of type M, so an arbitrary type M invariant. Okay? Consider the weight system of Vm. Well, it's an element in Rm reduced dual. So I can apply this construction to it. So I can compose it with Z. Okay? And I will get an invariant Vm prime, which unfortunately is not equal to Vm. Okay? All I know is that the weight system of Vm prime, so if I differentiate Vm prime m times, I will get the same as the m derivative of Vm. So I have that W of Vm prime is equal to W of Vm. Right? I didn't necessarily get back the invariant I started from. All I know is that once I differentiate, I get the derivative I wanted. Okay? But this means that if you look at the difference, Vm minus Vm prime, then the nth derivative of the difference, since these have equal nth derivatives, the nth derivative of the difference will be zero. Okay? So this will be an invariant of type n minus 1. So call it Vm minus 1. So this Vm minus 1 is of type m minus 1. So I can do the same construction. I can iterate. So I can look at Wvm minus 1, compose it with Z. It will give me an invariant Vm minus 1 prime, which unfortunately is not equal to Vm prime. It's not equal to Vm minus 1, but they differ by a Vm minus 2. Anyway, I keep doing this. And then it will stop at zero, and at the end I will find that Vm is equal to Vm prime plus Vm minus 1, which is equal to Vm, sorry, not m prime, Vm prime plus Vm minus 1 prime plus Vm minus 2, and so on. Right, so eventually, I'm just rewriting this equation, okay? And eventually I will get that Vm is equal to Vm prime plus Vm minus 1 prime plus Vm minus 2 prime, and so on. But each of these, each of the primed ones, is a composition of Z with something. So this is equal to WVM plus WVM minus 1 plus WVM minus 2 plus, and so on, composed with Z.
Why are you writing the composition on the right?
What?
Why are you writing the composition on the right?
Why am I writing the composition on the right? Because this is the bizarre rules of mathematics that you first do Z and then do W, you write the Z on the right.
I thought that you put it to
C now. No, first do Z, then do W.
Okay.
Sorry, that's fine. But anyway, so the moral is that every finite type invariant, Vm was arbitrary, and I've just shown that Vm is a composition of Z with some W. So Z contains in it all finite type invariants whatsoever. Okay? Every one. Okay, so that was, why is it called universal finite type invariant? Now, next point, why is this invariant called universal finite, why is this invariant a universal finite type invariant? And I'll do it even before showing that it's an invariant. Okay? So, the point is, and by the way, this is always easy. It's always the hard thing to show that something is invariant, but once it's invariant, proving the universality is always easy. It's a general principle. But anyway, why? So, I need to compute Z on a not K, where K is N singular. Has m double points, okay? So let me sort of do it pictorially. So let's draw a knot. Surprise. I'm sure you've never seen this one before. Let's make it m singular. So let m be 2. So let me put 2 singularities here, okay? And then let me compute Z of K. Z of K just means resolve this to an over, compute Z, resolve this to an under, compute Z, resolve. So look at the four, resolve this to over, under. You get 4 Z's, compute the 4 invariants, take the alternating sum. Okay? But these invariants are given by practically the same formulas. The formula is always the same messy integral. So it's actually relatively easy to compare them. Indeed, let me do the resolutions in a very, very small scale. So let me, when I break this up to an over minus under, let me make it sort of nearly the same. Let me modify the original knot only in a tiny vicinity of this singular point. Okay? Likewise here. Okay? And I can do that because I already know that Z is an invariant. Or I will later know that it's an invariant, so I can make these modifications as small as I want. Okay? But if I do this, then like then within this integral, if I have a chord that goes from here to here, then it will not even note. Then in the integrand, it will contribute the same way whether I've resolved this to an overcrossing or to an undercrossing. Because, well, I didn't even, resolving this to an over or an under does not modify this chord in any way, does not modify the ZI and the ZI prime of this chord in any way. Right? So, and if I have another chord going here, again it's irrelevant. So the only way the Concievich integral will notice the difference between over and under is if there is a tiny chord connecting the two sides here. So tiny that it is within the region being modified. If there is no such chords, I will never know the difference between over and under. The Concievich integral will not change. The part of the Concievich integral in which no such chord occur will not be modified. But likewise here, so there must be a chord here. If there isn't a tiny chord here, the Concievich integral will not see the difference. And in fact, if I had seven other double points, I would have to put a chord next to each one of them, otherwise the Concievich integral will vanish. So if there is a double point next to which there is no chord, then there is no difference between over and under. Okay? So the moral is that this starts in degree n. Okay? There is no contribution below degree n, because you must have at least n chords to put next to the n double points. Now let's look at the contribution which is precisely of degree n. Well, the only way to get something precisely of degree n is to put precisely one chord next to each double point. So, but if you put one chord next to each double point, what chord diagram do you get? Right, I mean, so the way to read out the chord diagram is to regard this, the knot as a circle and the chords become, well, the chords, okay? But if you put a chord next to each double point, the corresponding chord diagram is precisely the double point corresponding to that singular knot. So you'll get dk plus perhaps higher order stuff, but there is also a coefficient. Okay, I mean, you get something proportional to dk, but you have to figure out what the coefficient is. The coefficient is the difference between the integral corresponding to a single chord when you use an overcrossing minus when you use an undercrossing. Okay? But if you look at it, this is precisely the Cauchy integral. This is precisely don't look at it, just compute it. Compute it, the difference per chord comes out to be 2 pi I, but I divided by 2 pi I to the number of chords, so this becomes 1. Okay? Is this clear? So proving universality is easy. Proving invariance is hard. So let's do invariance. Any questions or comments? Yeah.
How do you decide? So you want to put a chord at every double point. How do you decide the chord connects the bottom two arcs or the upper two arcs? Because there are four things coming in at a vertex at a double point.
No, right? No.
Is it dependent if you choose it to be under or over?
No. Let's magnify what happens next to a double point, okay? Mm-hmm. Next to a double point, you see a crossing. Either an overcrossing or an undercrossing. depending which resolution you take, and you take both possibilities with opposite signs, okay? But anyway, the chord gets integrated over, so always I integrate over the placement of the chord, of the chords. So when I write this, I really mean you integrate over all possibilities of moving the chord between here and here. Okay? So it's all possibilities.
Throughout this region, basically.
You integrate on this region. Okay? But you know what? Let's look at it from... So you maybe I'll compute the complete the computation. Okay? So let's look at it from a time perspective, from the perspective of so let's slice this picture with the complex plane at different times. So at different times I get, well, so here is the complex plane, here is the, so let's start with the minimum t in which there is a, in which the two pictures differ, the picture for over and the picture for under, differ from each other. So at that minimum t, I have two points here. And then as time moves, the two points trade places. One goes above the other and the other goes below the other. Okay? And for the opposite crossing, the motion that you will see will be the opposite motion. So, this motion. Okay? And what are we integrating? We're integrating, the thing we're integrating is z, if this is z and z prime, we're integrating dz minus dz prime divided by z minus z prime, which is also called d of the logarithm of z minus z prime. And when you integrate a d, you just get the logarithm, the difference of well, the, well, I mean, anyway, you know what, I just do the integral, it's 2 pi I. Or rather, the difference between this one and that one is one point making a complete circle around the other, which is a 2 pi I. Okay? Okay, good. So I guess I can take another picture of this, but post only one. That requires loading my memory with more details. But anyway, okay, so why is it an invariant? So I've done the hard the easy thing, but now let's do the hard thing. Why is it an invariant? So, I wanted to start here. So, I don't know which one do you prefer. Should I use the... I can use the language of connections and curvature, or I could use brute force computations. And I think I want to do both of them very quickly. So whichever one you prefer, you can then go back and think harder. Okay? So in the language of connections and curvature, so let me state a general theorem. A general theorem for which this will be a special case. Okay? So let omega be a formal connection. So what's a, sorry, I don't know how much, I don't know how much I should use, how much am I allowed to use this language at all? So what's a connection? I really don't know what the background, I mean, I know for some people I know, and I know what their background is, but I don't know in general. So maybe I'll, a brief introduction to connections. What's a connection? So a connection is more or less a matrix valued one form. So you have a manifold, and for every tangent direction, you have a matrix. And then the point of having a so again, it's this is not what a connection is, but it's a good enough picture for what I need. Okay. So the point is that then if you have a path on the manifold, so if this is the manifold and you have a path along the manifold, you can well, to each tangent vector along the path, you get a matrix, and then you can multiply the matrices. So you can take the sort of prodigal, the product integral. You kind of subdivide into tinier and tinier pieces. For each tiny piece, you get a matrix, and these matrices become closer and closer to the identity if you make the subdivision close, sharper and sharper. But the point is that you, so it makes sense to multiply the matrices along the path, and that's the so-called holonomy of the connection. Okay? Here's a kind of formal version of that. So instead of taking values in a matrix algebra, take values in any graded algebra that has a unit, okay? But I want it to take a value in the degree one piece of this algebra. Of course, this can be generalized, but I mean, I just do the minimal thing that's enough for what I need, okay? So a connection will be a one form on the manifold with values in a graded algebra such that it's always of degree one. Okay? And then I'll multiply, well, sort of instead of multiplying the matrices, I'll kind of multiply 1 plus omega of the tangent along the path. So you'll take at any, you subdivide the path into small pieces. At any small piece, you compute 1 plus the connection evaluated on the tangent. This is a degree 0 thing plus degree 1 thing. You multiply these things along the path. What do you get? Okay? So, in degree 0, the only way to get a degree 0 thing is to multiply 1s, so you get 1. To get something of degree 2, sorry, to get something of degree 1, you have to take from this big product of things, you have to take one of the factors, take an omega, and all the other becomes 1, are 1s. Right? But in degree 2, which 1 do you take? Well, you have to choose to take all possibilities. This is, I guess, it's the distributive law, it's called. Right? So by the distributive law, you have to choose all possibilities of taking one of the factors and from it taking a 1, the degree 1 piece. So basically, you just get the integral of omega along the path. Okay? How do you get something of degree 2? Well, you have to take from all of the factors but 2. You take the 1, but then from 2 factors, you must take the omega, the degree 1 thing. So you integrate over all placements of t1 and t2. So at time t1, you take 1 omega, and at time t2, you take the second omega. So you get an integral over all t1 is less than t2 of omega times omega. And so on. So the formal holonomy of a formal connection along a path gamma from the unit interval to the manifold is this integral written here. But here is the precise definition of this integral. So whenever you have a map gamma from the interval to M, it induces a map phi from the M simplex to the manifold to the Mth power. Namely, the M simplex is the set of all ordered T1 up to Tm in the unit interval. And the map phi is simply mapping, it will map the point T1 up to Tm to gamma of T1, gamma of T2, Okay? And then then what you do is you pull back omega to the M, you take the connection omega and you make it into an M form on the manifold to the power M by wedging M copies of it with itself. And then you pull it back using phi to the simplex, and then you integrate and you sum over all M's, and the degree M piece will be coming from the M summand, and that's the formal holonomy of omega. Okay?
Is this bounded by the volume of the simplex?
Bounded by the volume of the simplex. There are no issues of convergence because the degree rises. I mean, I should have said completed graded algebra. So, there are no issues of, I don't care about convergence because the different terms live in different degrees. Okay? But still, if I am to answer your question, no, it's not it's not bounded by the volume of the simplex, because the integrand, I don't know what it is, it could be big. Nevertheless, in analytical situations, again, my situation in, I don't care about analysis, but in situations when you do care about analysis, generally speaking, you could bound this by a constant to the power m, but then it's integrated on a domain whose volume is 1 over m factorial, so generally speaking, often you can make it be convergent. But I don't care. Okay? Anyway, yeah. Sorry. It's the sum integral over m. The sum is over m, and the integral over is over the simplex. Okay. So theorem. Okay. So in ordinary differential geometry, people talk about connections often, right? And people say that, and there is a statement that says that if the connection is so-called flat, then its holonomy is independent. Well, you can deform the path while fixing the endpoints, and the holonomy will not change. And the issue is infinitesimal. Basically, you have to infinitesimally deform the path, and you basically have to, at the end, you have to take the difference between, you have to compare going along a parallelogram on the left or on the right, and if you make the parallelogram smaller and smaller, this difference becomes the curvature, and if the curvature is zero, the overall integral does not depend on the holonomy. Sorry, the overall holonomy does not depend on the path. Sorry, I'm just... So there is an analogous theorem here. So if the curvature of omega, this is not you, this is omega, but I kind of, I don't know. Clearly you can see that this is the letter omega. Okay? That's why generally I like to type my hand out. Anyway, so if f of omega, so if the curvature, which is d of omega plus omega wedge omega, is equal to zero, then the holonomy is independent under deformations that that preserve the endpoints. Okay. So if you've seen differential geometry, you don't want to see the proof again. If you haven't seen differential geometry, here is the proof. I'll say it very, very briefly. Okay? So basically, I need to take a path of passes. So I have a gamma, a path gamma, that also depends on a second parameter s. T is the time along the path, and s is the deformation parameter. Now, at any given time, I lift gamma to a map from the simplex to the manifold to the nth power. Right? So overall, I get a bigger phi, which for any given s, is a map from the simplex to the manifold to the nth power. Okay? And what I want to show, what I want is to compare the pullback of omega, sorry, the integral of omega to the m pulled back via phi 1, so via phi at s equals 1, and I want to compare it with this integral at s equals 0. Okay? And all I need is Stokes' theorem. So I look at this prism. This is an interval cross a simplex. An interval cross a simplex is a prism. Okay? And on that prism, I look at the integral of the differential of the form written here. By Stokes' theorem, it's equal to the integral of that form on the boundary of the simplex, of this prism. A prism has two boundaries, right? Or two types of boundary, right? If you have a prism, simplex cross an interval, it has the top boundary, a bottom boundary, and then and the boundary around. The top boundary is this one, the bottom boundary is this one, and the boundary around is the interval cross the boundary of the simplex. So what I've learned is that the difference that I want to compute is equal to the integral of d of the form minus a certain integral over the boundary of the simplex. So let's call the first one am, the second one bm. And then am is, well, I just need to take d of this pullback. And, well, since this pullback is just a wedge product of m pullbacks, d of it is up to signs, the sum of all ways of taking the one d omega at one place. So that's am. Bm is, well, you... what's the boundary of the simplex? So the simplex is... what did I do? What I did? I wanted to go previous. Okay. The simplex is this set. What's the boundary of this set? It's when either T1 is equal to 0, or Tm is equal to 1, or two of the variables in the middle become equal. Okay? And then you can check that if T1 is equal to 0, you get no contribution because I assume that I do not move the end points. If Tm is equal to 1, that's why I'm not moving the other end point as well. And if Ti is equal to Ti plus 1 in the middle, the contribution you get will be... in one place on the middle, you instead of having an omega, you get omega wedge omega. Again, I think this is the kind of things that are best done alone. And the reason I'm doing it is just to explain that there is nothing here other than differential geometric verification. Okay, but anyway, now you compare AM and BM, and you find that they are exactly the same, except here you have d omega and here omega wedge omega. So if d omega plus omega wedge omega is equal to 0, the theorem is proven. End of proof. If you're comfortable with pullbacks and differential forms and Stokes' theorem, sit on it for 15 minutes and you'll be convinced. If you're not comfortable, nothing that I can do will change it. I mean, the only thing is to go take a class, study it very hard. It's worthwhile, but it cannot be done right now. Okay? Anyway, So theorem 2 is proven. Okay? The holonomy is invariant under endpoint preserving homotopies. But now let's apply it in our special case. So what I want to show is that the Kontsievich integral is a holonomy of some connection. So first I have to define the connection. So for us, first of all, the manifold will be the complex number, the nth power of the complex numbers minus diagonals, minus all places where one coordinate is equal to another. What does it really mean? So what does this manifold really stand for, or what is really this manifold? So
points.
Yeah, of course. So what is C to the n minus diagonals? So, well, this is our manifold, but what is it? Well, it's just you take n points in the complex numbers, 1, 2, they're numbered, 1, 2, 3, 4, okay? And they're all different from each other, okay? So what's a path in this manifold? A path in this manifold is a braid. It's a motion of n points, right? I mean, Esther knows that better than me, and at some point she will show it. But a path in this manifold is just a motion of n points in time, which means a braid. So, okay. So our path gamma is just a braid. The algebra I will take is the same algebra that is written, what was erased, okay? But the same, the algebra of horizontal chord diagrams. The connection omega is the connection sum over I less than j, tij, omega ij, where omega ij is this lovely differential form that I used before. Okay, so basically, the connection is the sum over all ways of choosing two of these points, looking at the Cauchy form between them, and multiplying it by a horizontal chord going between the corresponding strands. So, well, here I should be having more strands, so it's the sum of all way of the... Well, okay. I claim that this is a flat connection, so I have to compute the curvature of omega. Well, the curvature of omega is d omega plus omega wedge omega. As it turns out, the two factors, the two terms, vanish independently. So their sum is twice equal to zero. No, it's never, just kidding. Okay? So D of the differential part, D of this form, each of these form is in itself, what is it called, closed. Because it's nearly exact. It's nearly D of the logarithm. And the only problem why it's not D of the logarithm is that the function log is not globally defined. But anyway, d of omega ij is equal to 0, so therefore d omega is equal to 0. Then you have to compute omega wedge omega. That's a messy computation, but the relations in the algebra A were precisely cooked to make it true. Okay? So, if you compute omega wedge omega, it involves a sum over, well, since omega is a sum over I and j, omega wedge omega will involve two such summations, and you will get tij omega ij, and then tkl omega kl, and then this splits into three parts. The part where the total cardinality of the set ij kl is 2, or 3, or 4. And the case where, well, basically you did, each case vanishes separately. The case where you have four, so when all four of those are different from each other, when all four indices are different from each other, the thing to use to prove vanishing is the relation Tij commutes with Tkl. If these four indices are actually three different numbers, then you have to check cases, and you just, at the end, it boils down to a small a small identity of forms of the form zi minus zj divided by, sorry, dzi minus dzj divided by zi minus zj, and it's the so-called Arnold identity. And this Arnold identity says that omega 1 2 wedge omega 2 3 plus cyclic permutations of this, so plus omega 2 3 wedge omega 3 1 plus omega 3 1 wedge omega 1 2 is equal to 0. And the only way to do it is to just write down explicitly everything, crunch, 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 and everything collapses. I don't know what else to say. Okay.
Just a comment. This is a very general recipe. As long as you have a Lie algebra which satisfies these relations, called infinitesimal braid relations, the same argument goes through and you get a flat connection given by these one
forms. Yeah, so, yeah. And in fact, that, this is, it's somehow an assertion that I made at the beginning. So we are now doing the high algebra chapter of braid theory. Okay? It's in fact, it's so high that it becomes that it's analysis. But I mean, but using low algebra, meaning interpreting everything in a specific Lie algebra, you will get statements about, so you get universal statements that can be then interpreted in any specific Lie algebra. So, again, I'm saying it in fancy language, it will become more concrete further later, so later on. So, I mean, I'm only agreeing with you, that's all. Anyway, so now to prove the invariance for braids, just take gamma to be, well, I mean, sorry, I think I already said that. Okay, what's the, how's the time?
The 3-4 minutes left.
3-4 minutes left. So you see, I want to forget about braids and move back to the knot case. And I want to explain, well, explain invariance for the knot case. Should I do it now or after the break?
I think there's people waiting already outside.
So, okay, so let's do it after lunch, okay? But within this, I've done the hard part. What comes now is soft. Okay.